So my advice would always be just as a student, this is the best time to start a company because you have like no risk. You have no, family to support. You have a very low expectation for your lifestyle, right? Because you're kind of living in a 4-bedroom apartment or a fraternity house or something, and you're used to eating ramen noodles and cravings all day, so you're fine, right?
Welcome back to the Innovations at Research Park podcast. Tune into our show to hear insightful conversations on what innovations Research Park students, companies, and alumni are creating. I'm your host, Tanmay Shah, and today I'm joined by Paul Kustin. Paul is the co-founder and CEO of Ascent Integrated Tech, a startup company in the Research Park that is building technology to improve safety for people in hazardous environments, including firefighters, industrial operators, and aviation mechanics. Paul is a seasoned entrepreneur and well-known in the student startup ecosystem on campus, having previously co-founded a tech company for solar integration, for which he raised more than $2.5 million in private equity funding, all while being an undergrad at U of I. I'm very excited to speak with Paul to understand his passion for creating businesses and what lessons he's learned along the way. Welcome to the show, Paul.
Hey, thanks so much for having me, man.
Cool. So like I mentioned in the introduction, you're a very seasoned entrepreneur on campus. You've been through the paces. And I'm just curious, as my first question for you, what inspired this second entrepreneurial venture? And can you kind of describe the products that your company manufactures? And also just why the name Ascent Integrated Tech?
Yeah, absolutely. So really, when it came down to it, I kind of fell into entrepreneurship on campus with my first venture. I took a couple technology entrepreneurship courses, specifically TE250 with Harley Sorkin. And that's kind of where I fell in love with the idea of like doing good customer discovery, understanding problems and needs in the market, and then trying to solve them. So I kind of caught that entrepreneurial bug that you hear kind of talked about. And from there, went to go start Optivolt, which was a great experience and really enjoyed working on that. After Optivolt, I picked up a couple contracts, but like found, a deep unhappiness, if you will, about working towards, I guess, other visions. So I have this bug, I guess, that I really, really obsess about customer problems and then try to build solutions for those customers. For Ascent, really what we're doing, and you kind of explained it pretty well. I mean, if you want to pitch for us anytime, you're more than welcome to. We build human performance technology that provides actionable insight to people like the fire captain or a SWAT captain. Anytime that there's kind of a small, high intensity squad that's entering into a burning building or really into any environment where humans shouldn't be, we stream, health, environmental, locational data back to the guy that's outside of that building, just so that way they can make better decisions and kind of act as a smarter guardian angel to keep that team safe. As for the name, a lot of that is just because our core competency is integrating solutions that are agnostic to the equipment that we're integrating into or agnostic to the chipsets that we're using. So really we consider ourselves more of like a solutions company toward all these operators in that, if there's for example, an infrared camera that they've been using for years and they really, really like, we don't try to then reinvent infrared cameras. We kind of integrate existing infrared cameras into those product offerings.
Okay. And if I understand correctly, so this is a hardware company, right? And you've got a suite of products that you can essentially test and eventually cater to these, let's say, fire captains or industrial operators. Is that correct?
Yeah. Hardware sometimes is a bad word here in Chicagoland. So I like to say that we're kind of a hardware-enabled SaaS company because the real value of what we're building is that command portal that incident commander interacts with, right? The firefighters themselves, they don't really care much for the hardware as long as it works. So while obviously there's a huge focus on making ruggedized hardware, the real focus of this company is how can we provide actionable insights that keep these guys safe, if that answers the question.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So kind of two thoughts from there, right? So the first one being, is this something that they can wear alongside their other gear, something like, you know, on their head, on their face? And then also you mentioned, you know, critical insights. What kind of metrics or what kind of data are you streaming back to the incident commander?
Yeah, great question. You know, one thing that we learned very early in our customer discovery, and, you know, just to provide some context, before we started this business, we participated in the National Science Foundation's iCORE program, which is a great resource on campus and nationwide to help specifically technical founders kind of step outside of the lab and go talk to end users to really understand the problem that they're looking to solve. In this case, we learned very quickly that firefighters and the rest of the customers that we build for, there's almost like this undying loyalty toward the equipment that they use. And I completely understand that, right? Because if you're running into a burning building and this equipment protected you in the past, you're definitely going to wear it again. So when we approached this solution, we had originally thought that we were going to build like our own gas masks and our own PPE. But we learned very, very quickly that that had a lot of friction to adopt because they have kind of this loyalty to existing products. So our focus is really on, well, how can we take that existing protective equipment that they know, love, and trust and make it a little bit smarter? So like you said, we integrate sensors into existing gas masks or existing fire helmets or ballistics helmets. We also do some work with gloves and communication systems and boots and ballistics armor. So really, we're pretty agnostic to the hardware that we integrate into. And a lot of the, we call them shield modules, but a lot of the kind of hardware modules that we use are pretty consistent no matter where they're mounted. And that is the piece of hardware that streams data back to that portal. And in terms of the type of data that we stream, you know, really it's kind of specific to the use case of the operator. That being said, there are some consistencies that's used all across these industries that we sell to, which is, you know, biometric data is really important. So heart rate and body temperature, pulse ox. We also do communication systems with a throat microphone and a bone conductive earpiece. And that's a separate piece of hardware that's kind of worn underneath the gas mask or the fire hood. And then for the actual module that we mount on, we can integrate infrared cameras, accelerometers, GPS units, IMUs. We can also do hazardous gas detection, combustible gas detection. And we also have little LEDs that kind of act as like a heads-up display. So if that incident commander looks at an operator and says, okay, this guy's got a high heart rate, maybe increasing body temperature, increasing ambient temperature, and perhaps they just experienced a sudden acceleration in like the negative y-axis. We can use that data together to extrapolate that maybe this firefighter just fell through a floor or down a staircase and may not be able to call a mayday. So we want to be able to notify not only the incident commander, but the rest of the team that, hey, there might be a firefighter down and we got to go find this guy. So it's a combination of all that sensor data that really brings value to that end user.
Perfect. Okay. And, you know, throughout this journey of this second venture for you, it sounds like you've, you know, before we started recording here, we were discussing your company's locations. You've got two locations now, both in Champaign Research Park, as well as Chicago, as well as a growing team. So can you kind of share some of those success stories you've been able to have thus far, as well as, you know, what kind of impact do you hope to create both in the short term as well as long term?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll start with Champaign, seeing how this is the Research Park podcast. Really in Champaign, obviously the University of Illinois is a very close-knit ecosystem, especially when it comes to startups and innovation. And a lot of that lives at Enterprise Works. So we have an office space there, you know, love kind of hanging out there. We take full advantages of all the types of services, like the shared services. So like a lot of our website, our logo, a lot of the media material that we have, was not only created through some of the shared services at EnterpriseWorks, but we actually found a lot of our first couple hires, like Molly Izzy recently joined us from that program. On top of that, we're also about a 5-minute walk from the Illinois Fire Service Institute, which is a world-renowned firefighting training academy. I think it's actually the oldest one in the U.S., and it's right here on campus, right at the University of Illinois. So we often run live burn tests there with the instructors. Both me and my co-founder, Alex Gorsuch, who is also a fellow Illini and a local there in Champaign. He's our CTO and does a lot of our tech development and tech leads. Sometimes me and him just kind of run through, you know, run on over to the Illinois Fire Service Institute, put on some of the old crusty bunker gear they have in the back closet, put on our prototypes and do some live testing in those burn buildings. So when it comes down to it, you know, and one thing that I'll probably talk quite a bit during about this podcast is customer discovery. You know, we talk to as many customers as we can. I think we've talked to over 350 firefighters to date. But sometimes the best way to learn about your customer's needs is to experience it yourself. Like I thought for the longest time that firefighters will want optical cameras. And then you get into a burn building and you realize it is pitch black. So optical cameras have no value. In terms of our Chicago location, we do a lot of work with MHUB, which is kind of a hard tech accelerator incubator space here in River West. And MHUB is great. They've been around, I think, for more than 5 years at this point. They took like an old Motorola facility and turned it into like a hardware accelerator that has access to about $6 million worth of production equipment. So we're part of their IIoT accelerator program. It's one of the first accelerator programs that MHUB has started. So we're very happy to be part of that. In addition, with MHUB, we also have a very, very close partnership with WS Darley Co., which is a huge company here in Chicagoland. They've been around for about 110 years. They were selling fire equipment and fire supplies to the fire industry back when it was like a predominantly like horse-drawn carriages as the fire trucks. So they've been around for quite a while. And now they're one of the leaders in terms of global distribution of fire equipment. And we're actually their first investment that they've made into a startup in the 110 years that they've been around. So very, very happy to be working with them. We're working on some strategic distribution deals once we get to market. So very close with Paul Darley and Kevin Sofin and Peter Darley, Jason Darley, a couple of those folks over there. And really, really excited to be kind of local here in the Midwest, but really still have that focus on innovation down in Champaign.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you mentioned, you know, being very homegrown as it relates to both your founding team, as well as your office locations and the facilities you're able to leverage. So how much of that do you think will play into eventually your goal for national expansion? And this kind of ties into, you know, your long-term visions here for this company. Do you see yourself wanting to cater to, you know, let's say the firefighters in California and New York? You know, what's your vision for national expansion?
Yeah, so like I said at the very beginning, our main focus on this company has been customer discovery. We don't really do anything until we talk to a customer, and the customer guides a lot of our kind of decision making and feature set. So those 350 firefighter interviews that I mentioned were all across the country. And we've turned those initial discovery interviews into eventual kind of acquisition interviews where we kind of gauge your interest in a pilot. And to date, we have about 40 fire departments all across the nation, across about 17 states that are currently piloting with us starting next year. So a lot of them are in the Midwest, but we do have a presence out on the West Coast and the East Coast. I think there's a huge value proposition to being right here in the Midwest in that a lot of innovation obviously happens out on the West Coast. But a lot of the firefighters that we work with here in the Midwest, you know, they're very open to adopting new technology. And especially since we are working with the Illinois Fire Service Institute, that helps build quite a bit of credibility with a lot of these Midwestern fire departments because they all train in Champaign. So I will say that, you know, Chicago is a great town to build any sort of technology company, mainly because, you know, you can keep your cost of living lower than maybe on the West Coast. You can have a little bit of a scrappier mindset out here. And, you know, there are a lot of manufacturing partners, even in like Michigan and, you know, throughout the greater Midwest, that are very much cost competitive and open to, you know, small and medium volume runs. So a lot of value in being here in the Midwest. I will also say, from a personal note, just, you know, being a University of Illinois founder, back when I was a student, we would make so many trips up to Chicago, right? There was Think Chicago, and a couple other events that we participated in, that really helped us grow our network up in Chicago. And then I also participated in TechStars Chicago with my first company, which really opened up the door to seeing who, you know, really understood the tech industry up in Chicago and who could be some great mentors and advisors for me. And a lot of those early mentors and advisors that I made connections with when I was a student are now, you know, formal advisors and potentially even investors in my current venture. So that's kind of the power, I think, of the network that you can develop while you're a student, and then the payoff that you'll see once you're a little bit farther along in your entrepreneurial journey.
Yeah, it's amazing to see, you know, you discuss this wealth of experience you've had, not only with entrepreneurship, but also with growing your network. And, you know, it hasn't been too long since you were a student. So I'm curious, you know, as such a young leader with, you know, a founding team, with employees, with partners who may be a lot older than you, what kind of leadership style do you personally employ? And can you share some examples maybe of how you've been able to establish a smooth running operation with that distinctive style you may have adopted?
Yeah, for sure. You know, I will say with any industry, like, ageism is always a thing, right? If you're a young founder, that's always going to be a point of criticism that you'll hear from both investors and from customers. That being said, in my experience, one way to combat that, I guess, critique that, you know, external parties may have, is just kind of silence them with traction and progress, right? Because all of a sudden, all those concerns about age go away when you start proving out that you've proven out early product market fit, you really understand the problem, and you're building good solutions that solve them. People start taking you a lot more seriously when you have those kind of metrics and that kind of traction behind you. So even when I was first starting Ascent and we didn't have as much traction or as much progress done, I got a lot of those comments. Now that we've started growing, we have the traction, early signs of product market fit, I don't get those kind of comments as often. When it comes to the leadership style, you know, I really do believe in hiring right and, you know, finding the right co-founding team, finding the right advisors early on in the company's life. Mainly because that makes your job as the founder, the co-founder of the team, a lot easier, because you just listen to the experts. You hire people that are smarter than you. You get advisors on that are more experienced than you. And then your only job as a leader is to take all the data points that are being thrown at you, all the opinions, all the pieces of advice, and kind of sorting through it to find the most valuable little nuggets and implement those pieces throughout the company. And I would also say the last thing too is just don't, or as much as you can, try not to waste people's time. You know, we have one 45-minute meeting a week, the all hands meeting, typically on Mondays. That is the only time where there's like a quote unquote mandatory all hands company meeting. The rest of the week, if you want to hop on a one-on-one or you want to bring in three or four people, do so, right? But as, you know, a co-founder, I don't force anyone to show up to a meeting unless they organized it or unless their opinion or their expertise is directly applicable. So I think that's another way that you as a leader can gain credibility, is like, don't throw 30 hours worth of meetings on people's calendar, especially as a remote team too, because you're going to lack a lot of engagement in those meetings and people are going to feel like their time and their expertise is being wasted.
Yeah, agreed. It's, you know, as a leader, your main job, as you stated before, is to enable your team. And one way of doing that is giving back time that, you know, may not be needed for unnecessary meetings. So I definitely agree with that. So I want to kind of shift the conversation a little bit here and talk about, you know, just before you were able to grow this team and get to where you are now, you went through a couple of rounds of funding. You went through this experience where you were kind of in front of investors and wanting to gain their trust, right? So I'm curious, you know, how do you prepare for these meetings where you are pitching to get potential funding? And more specifically, how do you overcome these potential mental blocks that may force you to think that, you know, you're too young, you're not suited for this, these investors are looking for somebody else, someone more qualified? What's your kind of your battle plan, so to say, when you're going into these meetings?
Yeah, that's a great question, and something that I actually mentor and give back to the community quite a bit on through guest lecturing and such. You know, I think the biggest thing that people need to take away from this is you're going to hear a lot of no's, and your job as a co-founder or as a founder is to just be okay with that. Even on my last round, I mean, I could pull up my CRM, but there were close to about 100 contacts that I had sent an email to, cold called, got a warm introduction to. And from those roughly 100 potential investors, we have 14 currently on the cap table. So if you look at that math, you know, in general, for every one yes that you hear, you're going to hear 9 no's, right? Same thing with some of the fire departments that I'm piling with. Not everybody is going to be an early adopter. And that's okay. You just have to kind of accept that as a reality when you're starting a new venture. A couple things that I always recommend is everybody thinks that their startup is like special or unique. But it's sad to hear that it's not. you know, everyone wants to obsess about the product, obsess about the value proposition. And you'll see that quite a bit in presentations or media or anything that's shared externally, especially first-time founders. They get so granular, so nitty-gritty into the detail of the product, the feature set, and they forget to kind of tell the bigger picture and the bigger story here, which I will say that for most of my investor meetings, for example, it starts as a 30-minute video call or in-person call. And I can get through my pitch deck in about 5 minutes. And that's about as much time as I tend to want to spend on the pitch deck. Because a lot of fundraising, a lot of customer discovery that eventually moves into customer acquisition is about building relationships, not so much about your presentation. So your presentation should really explain your credibility as the management team, explain the problem, explain your solution, and then show your traction. And then you need to get out of the presentation once you accomplish those four goals. And I see a lot of first-time founders spending 20 minutes of those 30 minutes on the presentation. And, you know, maybe half of that time is spent directly on the product. And that's not only a turnoff to investors, but you'll lose engagement very quickly because you're not answering their questions. So that's one piece of advice I always have when it comes to prepping. It's less important about your presentation, even less important about the 5 minutes that you are presenting, and much more important on how you answer their questions and then how you follow up and what you send during those follow-ups as well.
But at the same time, though, you know, you want to be careful that you're not sharing too little and just keeping this open, you know, keeping the floor open for a Q&A session. How do you find that balance between knowing what to share in those 5 minutes and kind of, you know, expecting certain questions to come out of that, knowing that you've only, revealed maybe 50% or 60% of what you had to say?
Yeah, that's a great question. I will say that much like customers, every investor has their own preference as well. So the reason why I like to keep most of the meeting open for Q&A is because I don't know from the very beginning of that meeting what that investor cares the most about. very similar to when I go into a customer demonstration. I spend maybe 5 or 10 minutes explaining the product and the value proposition, and I let that fire chief have the rest of the time to ask questions. Because your job is to tell a concise story in a very short amount of time, but really serve as kind of the expert to that audience. You never know. A fire chief, for example, could care less about the hardware and is really obsessed about, well, what happens when I press this button on the portal? Or an investor might care very little about your team, and they might care more about your unit economics. Whereas literally the next meeting over, that investor is obsessed about team and doesn't care at all about unit economics. So what I typically do is I'll come into the presentation with a 9, maybe 10 slide pitch deck. But then I'll have what I call the war chest in the back end of that presentation, where I have close to 40 slides ready. So that way their presentation is custom tailored to their preference. So if they ask me a question about unit economics, for example, I know exactly where that's at in my war chest. I flip through all the slides and show them that slide. Because that's what they really want to spend their time learning about. So I don't want to waste their time explaining things that they don't have any real preference to learn about, at least at the first meeting.
Yeah, that's great advice. And you know, you're talking a lot here about kind of the mechanics of how to go about being successful in getting funding for a venture. And I'm sure a lot of these skill sets you picked up through, you know, TEC or through other programs while being a student at U of I. I'm curious, and I know you already mentioned a few of these, but if you can just kind of highlight, you know, what are some of those programs that you were able to take part in while studying school there? And you know, what advice would you have for folks who may be just getting started with their college career and maybe interested in some of these organizations or programs?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we did pretty much everything that U of I had to offer. So we did COSAD. We were in the iVenture Accelerator cohort. We did Social Fuse, Silicon Valley, Think Chicago, the Illini Ideas Pitch Competition, the Startup Career Fair. I took probably 20 or so credit hours of TEC courses. So my advice would always be, just as a student, this is the best time to start a company, because you have like no risk. You have no, you know, family to support. You have a very low expectation for your lifestyle, right? Because you're kind of living in a 4-bedroom apartment or a fraternity house or something, and you're used to eating ramen noodles and cravings all day, so you're fine, right? And I will say that network that you develop when you're a student, everyone wants to help a student. So all these advisors, all these guest lectures that come through, like, send a follow-up email. Be that student that tries to connect after the guest lecture comes through, or after you go visit a tech office in Chicago. And you'll start developing that relationship. And that's exactly what we did at Optivolt when I was first there, is, we did all these programs, and then toward the end of our year with the iVenture cohort, actually Logan LaHive from the Techstars Chicago accelerator came down to campus to kind of scout out some potential talent for the next cohort. And me and my co-founder at the time, Rohit, sat down with Logan and kind of told him what we were doing. And, you know, then we got accepted to the first round interview and the second round interview. And we had applied to probably 15 accelerator programs, and we had gotten denied from 14 of them. Techstars was our last one. And we got accepted. So we actually took some time off of our studies to move up to Chicago. It was three of us at the time living out of a 2-bedroom, 1-bath, which was kind of uncomfortable, but hey, you know, we kind of made it work. And that's really where we got our first network. It really was from participating as a student from the University of Illinois in all these programs that eventually kind of opened the door to Chicago. And eventually from Chicago, we moved out to the Bay Area, raised a bunch of venture capital money, closed a defense contract, and started building a network out in the Bay Area as well. So it all started with that network that we built in Champaign. And now it's grown to the point that it's a lot easier to organize around, a lot easier to find customers and partners and talent when you have that kind of network that you developed when you were an undergraduate, when you really had like maybe five or six solid connections. Those grow very quickly.
Yeah. And you know, it's not only about the connections, I would say, but also about the mentorships you can gain from those, right? It's really about, you know, the phrase goes, it's about who you know, but I think it's also about how you're able to leverage that relationship and really gain what you can from folks who have expertise in X, Y, and Z. So that being said, you know, how have you kind of found those mentors for your journey to guide you? And maybe what advice could you offer about maximizing that relationship either as a mentor or as a mentee?
Absolutely. And I'll just start by saying I would not be where I'm at today without the mentors that I met 3, 4, 5 years ago. I mean, these are people who truly believe in giving back. And almost every single one of the mentors that we talk to, you know, the reason why they do it is because when they were first starting, someone took the time out of their day to give back and help them. So I almost look at it as this kind of continuously giving system that as you continue to learn more as an entrepreneur, you almost have like a moral obligation to send that elevator back down and help other people. Because there are some mentors that we met through, you know, the U of I network, through Techstars, that, I mean, I can't like live without their advice. Like obviously Harley Sorkin has been a mentor for me since my freshman year, but then there's people like John Rinaldi who have, we met through the Techstars network. He's a CEO at Geobit. You know, we have some other people too that are kind of more personal to me, like John Thode, who's also a University of Illinois lecturer, teaches through the TEC, Sharon Ephraim, Mark Tebbe. There's a lot of people. The list goes on and on, right? I could probably spend another 5 minutes listing off University of Illinois mentors that have just really helped me get there. So mentorship's a huge part of it. And the one thing that I will kind of leave as a piece of advice for mentorship is never look at these people like they're check writers, right? Look at these people like they're a wealth of knowledge that's going to help you find check writers one day. And if they do become check writers, then like be pleasantly surprised. But you do need to come into that relationship being coachable, being humble, understanding that you can make mistakes and that you will continue to make mistakes. And they're serving as kind of a branch of experience that you have yet to kind of understand fully. So you just kind of have to take their advice in stride. And, you know, I've gotten some brutal advice sometimes from advisors, and that's okay, right? That's why you work with them, is because they tell you what you need to hear, not what you want to hear.
Yeah, that's great advice. So just a couple more questions for you here before we wrap up. And you know, along those same lines about kind of knowing what to ask and knowing how to nurture those relationships, along with people, there's always books, right? There's always resources outside of your network. I'm just curious, you know, what are some of those, you know, books, podcasts, publications, et cetera, that you find useful?
Yeah. You know, I think there's a lot of knowledge out there and a lot of great resources. I listen to a bunch of different podcasts, a bunch of different books, but I think if you are just getting started on things, just go back to the basics, right? Like 0 to 1, which I'm sure everybody in the startup ecosystem knows about. But a lot of that, those principles come from, you know, the same camp as the National Science Foundation's iCORE program with like lean startup methodology. It really just comes back to talking to customers. So any early literature that you can find on customer discovery, empathy interviews, understanding the problems to be solved, the work or the job to be done, that's really important. One personal preference that I'll put in there, which is probably outside of the realm of like traditional startup literature, is Never Split the Difference by Chris Voss. It's one of those books that if you're a first-time founder, or even a second-time founder, just kind of like learning how to negotiate and how to kind of engineer the situation to kind of maximize outcomes for both parties is a super great skill to learn. Chris Voss was I think he worked with the FBI. He was like a hostage negotiator. So he would hop on the radio with people that had very much unreasonable demands and find a way to either buy more time or meet in the, you know, or find a way to keep those hostages safe while convincing, you know, that, you know, that criminal, I guess, to understand and empathize with the situation. So I thought that was a great book. The other thing that I'll mention too is anything that's industry specific, you know, find some of the leaders in the space, and a lot of those, you know, CEOs and founders, they have books that they've written. Great place to kind of learn about your industry too. Like Darley has a book called Sold, The Art of Relationship-Based Sales. So I've been reading that one, which is like very much custom tailored to the fire industry, but generally a good book as well. So that's where I would kind of start.
Yeah, amazing. So just to wrap up here, are you looking for any interns or full-time employees? I know you mentioned that your team is actively growing. So if so, you know, where can listeners find out more and apply?
Yeah, yes, we absolutely are. If you go directly to our website, you can Google Ascent Integrated Tech, or it's ascentitech.com. That's a great place to kind of see what we have actively open. That being said, you can always shoot me an email right on the website as well. And we are looking for student interns, obviously, but also looking for professionals as well. We're just now gearing up for our next fundraise, so we're very much well capitalized and you know, still in the early stages. So we tend to focus on people who have, you know, prior project work or something that they took ownership of, that entrepreneurial type mindset, but very much open to interviewing anyone who has passion for building technology that keeps first responders safe.
Amazing. Yeah, well, that's all I got, Paul. Thanks for coming to the podcast. You can find out more about Paul and his team at ascentitech.com. That's ascentitech.com. Or just about Research Park at researchpark.illinois.edu. Of course, we have other conversations coming just like this one. So please make sure you're subscribed so you don't miss out on future episodes. But I hope you enjoyed this one. Thanks again, Paul. And we'll see you next time.